This BBC podcast is supported by ads outside the UK.
There's a divide in American politics between those who think democracy is in peril and those who think it's already been subverted, hollowed out from the inside. As President Trump returns to the White House, we go through the looking glass into a world where nothing is as it seems. The Coming Storm from BBC Radio 4. Listen wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
Egal, ob Sie gerade erst beginnen oder Ihr Sicherheitsprogramm erweitern, herausragende Sicherheitspraktiken zu demonstrieren und Vertrauen aufzubauen, ist wichtiger denn je. Vanta automatisiert die Einhaltung von ISO 27001, SOC 2 und mehr, spart Ihnen Zeit und Geld und hilft Ihnen, das Vertrauen Ihrer Kunden zu stärken. Darüber hinaus können Sie Sicherheitsüberprüfungen vereinfachen, indem Sie Fragebögen automatisieren und die Sicherheit Ihrer IT-Infrastruktur mit einem kundenorientierten Trust Center demonstrieren. Über 9000 globale Unternehmen wie Atlassian, Flow Health und Koora nutzen Vanta bereits, um Risiken zu managen und Sicherheit in Echtzeit nachzuweisen. Erhalten Sie ein spezielles Angebot von $1000 Rabatt unter vanta.com/horen.
Hello and welcome to NewsHour from the BBC World Service, coming to you live from London. I'm James Kimaraswamy. After 15 months of fighting and the deaths of tens of thousands of people, 3 hours may not seem like much, but this morning's delay to the ceasefire in Gaza spoke volumes about the levels of distrust between Israel and Hamas. That last-minute hitch would have tied another knot in the stomach of hostage families and sown more doubts in the minds of civilians in Gaza, hoping for some kind of return to a normal life. Well, the ceasefire did finally come into effect nearly 4 hours ago after Hamas released the names of the first 3 hostages they'll release. We don't know exactly when they or the larger number of Palestinian prisoners being freed by Israel will appear. But for the moment, it seems the skies over Gaza are quiet and there is plenty of movement on the ground. We've seen images of displaced Gazans heading back to their homes, and the UN says the first aid trucks have arrived in the territory. In today's programme, we'll hear from the hospitals waiting to receive those hostages, from Gaza itself and from the UN's senior humanitarian coordinator in the region. First, though, here's how the events unfolded in the hours leading up to the truce. At 7:30 a.m. local time, an hour before the ceasefire had been due to come into effect, Israel's Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu instructed his army not to halt its operations in Gaza because Hamas had not provided the names of those first 3 hostages to be released. Hamas blamed that on undisclosed technical reasons. And so, the bombing continued in Gaza. But then, just after 10 a.m, Israeli media reported that Hamas had supplied the hostage names. And minutes later, Israel's cabinet minister Itamar Ben-Gvir resigned from the government, together with other ministers from his far-right Jewish Strength Party. Then at around 10:30, Hamas published the names of the 3 women they say will be released today: Romy Gonen, Doron Steinbrecher and Emily Damari, a dual UK-Israeli national. And then at 11:15, 470 days and nearly 5 hours since the killings and abductions that led to Israel's military response, the truce did come into force. Well, Qatar has been the main mediator between the 2 sides, and soon after the ceasefire began, the Qatari Foreign Ministry spokesperson Majed Al Ansari spoke to the BBC.
This is a deal for hope. This is a deal for the future. This is a deal for all of us collectively. It's not a deal between Hamas and Israel only. It's a deal for peace in our region. The implementation of this deal will mean that we can see hope for our children in the future and our children's children. And this is why and how all of us should be dealing with this deal. It's a chance for peace. It's a last chance for peace. And we need to work together to make sure that it happens.
According to the Hamas-controlled Gazan Health Ministry, nearly 47,000 Palestinians have been killed in the fighting, although those figures do not distinguish between civilians and fighters. More than 1 million people have been displaced from their homes, and large numbers of them are currently heading back to their neighbourhoods, in many places which have been flattened by the sustained Israeli bombing campaign. We can speak now to Dr. Mohammed Abu Mogaseb, who's Deputy Medical Coordinator for the medical charity Médecins Sans Frontières. He's based in Rafah in southern Gaza. Doctor, many thanks for joining us. Can you tell us, first of all, what is happening on the ground today? Are the skies still quiet over Gaza?
As maybe you are all watching, I mean, yes, the sky now is quiet. Since 470 days, we never have this kind of quietness. I mean, and there is no sounds of shelling or airstrikes. So things are quiet.
But how hopeful are you that this ceasefire deal is going to last?
I mean, again, there is hope. I mean, first of all, I mean, we lived fear. I mean, I'm a Palestinian doctor. I'm working with myself, but I'm Palestinian from Gaza. So, I mean, all this fear, I mean, is, I hope, over. But, I mean, the pain, I mean, you know, the destruction. A lot of population are already evacuated from their places, so they need to go back to the places, to Rafah or to the north area or Gaza City. I mean, everything is almost destroyed. I mean, the infrastructure, schools, hospitals, clinics, everything is destroyed in Gaza, partially or totally. I think there is a lot to do, and the people have hope. I mean, people, at least they have mixed feelings. They can feel that they are tired from all this war, but with the mixed feelings.
And they don't know what they're going to go back to, but clearly for many, it's going to be, well, destruction, isn't it?
Of course. I mean, people who are now living in the tents and IDBs, they will go back to their homes and they will find that their homes are destroyed. So they will move their tent and they will implement their tents on the rubbles of their houses or homes. So things are not easy. I mean, people still are in this kind of status of shock. It's the first day of ceasefire. We hope that it will continue and end to an end of this war. Of course, some of them are not optimistic still. I mean, they could say that it can be break again, the ceasefire. So, I mean, the situation is not easy. The population has been suffering here a lot since 470 days, not in terms of as well security, in terms of material. There was no health structure available to support them. There is no humanitarian aids entering enough. There was no food. There was no drinkable water. So, I mean, you're speaking about all means of life. I mean, it has been disturbed.
And briefly, what are you expecting then in terms of help, medical aid that your organization needs?
I mean, we were calling to scale now up all the humanitarian aids to enter. I mean, there is huge needs, as I mentioned, mainly in the health section. Hospitals are damaged. There is no human resources as well enough. We need to have health experts to enter and support the hospitals, to implement field hospitals as well in some areas which have no more hospitals running or no more buildings there. So, I mean, the needs are, we are now in the phase where the population will go. We will go with the population as well. We will try to follow the population.
Dr. Mohamed Abu Mogaseb from Médecins Sans Frontières in the Rafah humanitarian zone in southern Gaza. Thanks very much. Well, let's turn to Israel now. And Hostages Square is a public plaza in central Tel Aviv where hostages' families have been camped since the October the 7th attacks. A large digital screen there counts the days, the hours, the minutes and the seconds since their relatives were abducted. Before the names of the first hostages to be released were made public this morning, Gil Dickman spoke to the BBC from the square. His cousin Carmel was taken hostage on October the 7th and she was shot dead by her captors last August.
On the one hand, you think, oh my God, she might be coming in just a few hours. You start to think about what you're going to get for her. You start, you know, packing the luggage for the moment she's here. And on the other hand, you keep remembering that it all might collapse in just one moment, and that's really agonizing. For all of us, it is bittersweet here today because it's good to see this ceasefire finally on the way, but it's too late already. It's too late already for Carmel, who was supposed to be on the list for this very, very ceasefire, for this very deal. And it's too late for all the hostages here that are still there, actually, because it doesn't matter even who comes out today. There have been 471 days in captivity. That's way, way too long, and I don't want to start thinking about what they've been through there. That's all in our minds as families of hostages. That's definitely in the minds of the families who are awaiting family members. But the most important thing is that we start, because we want this war to end. And what I'm afraid of is that this is only a temporary ceasefire, that we'll see only 33 hostages coming, and then the war will resume. This is not what we want. We want this ceasefire to start as quickly as possible, and then to end this war completely with all 97 hostages coming back home. We have to get this over with.
Gil Dickman there, 33 hostages that he talked about. They're the ones that are due to be released in this first phase of the ceasefire 3 today. Well, let's speak to the BBC's Jonah Fisher, who's at the Sheba Medical Center near Tel Aviv. What's happening there, Jonah? What's the atmosphere like?
Well, they are making preparations here for the likely arrival of these three female hostages, which are, we are told, in terms of the schedule, due to be released at 4 o'clock local time. That's in about 45 minutes, though there are some reports in the Israeli media that that exchange has actually taken place early, and they could in fact already be handed over to the Red Cross in Gaza. How it's going to work is they will be given to the Red Cross, who will then take them to the IDF, the Israeli military forces inside Gaza, and then they will be brought outside to an assessment point just inside Israel, and then probably flown by helicopter to the outskirts of Tel Aviv, which is where I'm speaking to you from now, the Sheba Medical Center, one of the biggest hospitals in the Middle East. And I'm just outside the place where they're going to be received. They're putting up large fences and tarpaulins because this is not going to be a public event, a public reunion. These are three women who have obviously gone through an unbelievably difficult time. Two of them, we think, got sustained injuries during the course of the October the 7th, 2023 attack by Hamas. So it's likely that this will take place when they are brought here, far away from the journalists and cameras who are outside the hospital at the moment. And we may be reliant on the authorities for any pictures of the reunions with families when they do take place here.
And what of the other side of the exchange? We think 90 Palestinian prisoners are going to be free. Do we know anything about the timings of that?
We don't know the timings. The reason why it's 90 is there is basically a formula which has been outlined as part of the peace agreement, whereby different types of Israeli hostages have a different value in terms of how many Palestinians get released. And for a female citizen, a non-military female, it seems that 30 Palestinian prisoners is the number. So we are expecting them to that 90 Palestinian prisoners could well be released today. Obviously, the exact protocol of how that will happen and how quickly after the three female Israeli hostages are in Israeli hands that will happen, I'm not across the details of that at the moment.
Okay, and briefly, Jonah, the politics of today inside Israel. We had Itamar Ben-Gvir, one of the cabinet ministers, resigning, and we've had another cabinet minister, the finance minister, Bezalel Smotrich, saying in the last sort of half hour or so he would overthrow the government if it does not return to fighting in a way that would occupy Gaza. What should we make of these in terms of what it means for Benjamin Netanyahu going forward?
Well, we've been hearing this sort of thing for the last few days as details of the deal came through. This had already been pretty heavily trailed by Itamar Ben-Gvir, the security minister. He threatened to resign if the deal went through. Clearly, it's gone through, so he's been left with little choice. It should be said that Mr. Netanyahu's government is still technically in the majority, even with the departure of Mr. Ben-Gvir.
Jonah,
if he loses the other far-right group,
Jonah,
then he'll
Fisher,
be in real trouble.
We have to leave it there. Thank you. The headlines at this hour: the long-awaited Israel-Gaza ceasefire is coming to force after Hamas released the names of the first hostages it will free. In Gaza itself, thousands of displaced people have already begun heading back to their homes following the implementation of the truce. And in other news, TikTok has gone offline in the United States, hours before a new law banning the platform was due to come into effect. You're listening to NewsHour, live from London, from the BBC World Service. We're going to get more now on the ceasefire in Gaza and the release of the Israeli hostages and Palestinian prisoners. Let's get an update on what is, of course, just the beginning of the first phase of a three-phase process. We can speak live to the Israeli government spokesman, David Mensah. Good afternoon to you.
Good afternoon. Good to be with you.
And what can you tell us about the news that we were just hearing from our correspondent, that perhaps the three first hostages, the three women who are being released, that release may have actually happened already? It might have happened early.
Jamie, I can tell you that we are a nation collectively holding its breath at the thought of three of our precious daughters of Israel coming home. We're a nation which is consumed by the plight of our hostages. We find ourselves all at once elated, while at the same time dreading outcomes. Why? Because we've heard from the mouths of those who've already returned home the accounts of rape, of torture, and of dungeons. So for Israelis, this is an emotional roller coaster, and it's simultaneously its relief, its joy, its dread, its apprehension, its trepidation. And the knowledge that after 471 days, how can they be held by monsters? So this is, I tell you, the collective emotion here in Israel.
Bitter relief, I have seen it described as. Is that how you might characterize it?
Look, we're fearing for those who will not come home alive, that some are wounded, and also for the families that did not live to see their loved ones come home. It's a moment of tears, it's a moment of love. But Jamie, most of all, it's a moment of humanity. We need to get these people out of that hellhole and out of the hands of those monsters.
Absolutely, but there are people going in the opposite direction, and they are convicted criminals, Palestinian prisoners, and you know full well that many Israelis are uncomfortable about that aspect of the deal. We've seen one member of the government resign today, another suggesting he will if the military campaign is not resolved. How concerned are you about the national security implications of who's going back into Gaza and what it could mean for keeping Israel and your government together?
The majority of the government voted in favour of this difficult agreement. The majority of Israel's people, all the branches of Israel's security forces, the IDF and the Mossad, have all supported this agreement. And the Prime Minister made clear last night that President Trump had welcomed this agreement and rightly emphasised that this is the first stage of this agreement and it is a temporary ceasefire. That is what President Trump said, a temporary ceasefire. So ahead of the next stages of this agreement, we hope they do indeed come to pass. But we are retaining significant assets in order to return all of our hostages and also to meet the objectives of this war. So both President Trump and outgoing President Biden have both given full backing to Israel if there is a need to return to the fighting.
And do those objectives remain the same? Obviously, the focus today is on the hostages and will be for the next few weeks, but the other objective was to destroy Hamas, and that clearly has not been achieved.
So Hamas have been greatly degraded. There should be no doubt. If there is a need, Israel will return to the fighting with great force. We will not give up until all the goals of this war are met. They are the return of our hostages, and yes, they remain the removing of Hamas's terrorist regime in Gaza, not for Israel, but for the future of Gaza, because Gaza needs to be liberated from Hamas.
David Mensah, Israeli government spokesman, thanks very much. Well, the timing of the ceasefire deal is, of course, linked to Donald Trump's return to office. His Republican administration will play a key role in overseeing the deal's implementation. And on Monday, the 45th president of the United States will also become the 47th when he's inaugurated indoors in Washington, D.C. This weekend, he's been back in the US Capitol, where his supporters have been holding parties to mark the beginning of a very rare non-consecutive second presidential term. It is, in fact, 132 years since Grover Cleveland became the only other person to achieve that. Washington, though, is a solidly Democratic voting city, and many people there have a rather different view of a second Trump presidency. And NewsHour's Nuala McGovern has been speaking to some of them.
There are sounds from the protest that has taken place in Washington, D.C., in advance of Donald Trump's second inauguration. It was called the People's March, and it drew thousands to this city. The marchers wanted to highlight women's reproductive rights, as well as other causes that they believe are under threat from the incoming Trump administration. And I wanted to talk to some of them who took part.
So I've just stopped a couple of women that are walking ahead of me on the street coming from the People's March. Is that right?
That's correct.
What's your name?
Sonia.
Sonia, nice to meet you. Why did you go?
After the election, I was in a deep depression and I cried a lot. And I saw this quote that said, "Action is the antidote to despair." And I thought, normally I don't go to marches. I keep my opinions to myself, but this was just too big. I have to start doing something.
And you're with your daughter and your friend. Mm-hmm. What did it mean to be there?
I'm from an area that is pretty red. I currently live in the middle of Wisconsin, a really big mega area. So I feel pretty alone there. So it was nice to be around people that think the same way as me, and to just remind myself that, yeah, we're out there.
You know, I was here 8 years ago for the inauguration and presented during that time. And then that evening, I remember going down to the train station to meet all the women that were coming that had knitted these pussy hats, pussy hats for this huge march the next day. I mean, every street, wherever I went in DC, was filled with women that were protesting. But I don't feel or see that here this time. Mm-hmm. I'm wondering how you see that or how you feel it. Your daughter's here. Hi, what's your name?
Abby.
Hi, Abby. What do you think?
I think people are more scared now because Trump people can be a little scary.
Yeah, I guess I could agree with that. And, you know, like after January 6th, 4 years ago, seeing how aggressive and mean the MAGA people can be then, I think because it's right before the inauguration, yeah, people are probably afraid to be in town right now.
As Sonia and Abby continue their journey, I saw a woman coming the other way also see their flags, and she leaned in towards them to offer words of encouragement. I wanted to know more about what she said and why.
I'm hopeful. I know that we're capable of what we're capable of. And as I said to the women that had been at the march, that we just have to be more involved in what we want our outcome to be. However, I have to recognize the outcome of the election. Those people voted for him. He is the president. And as of Monday, he's going to be in position. But what does that mean for us? It means that the rest of us and people that think like me, we can't throw up our hands. There's work for us to do, and we need to do that.
So they are the views of some who are not looking forward to Donald Trump taking the reins again. But thousands who are thrilled are about to descend on this city. They will welcome him on the eve of his historic return to the White House at his last rally as President-elect Trump.
And that was Nuala McGovern reporting from Washington, D.C. And Nuala will be hosting all the coverage of the inauguration here on the BBC World Service tomorrow. You're listening to NewsHour from the BBC World Service, coming to you live from London. Welcome back to NewsHour. More on the ceasefire in Gaza in just a minute, but let's turn to South Korea now, because the unfolding saga of that country's impeached president, Yoon Suk-yeol, has taken another violent turn. That is the sound of hundreds of his supporters storming the Seoul Western District Court after a judge extended President Yoon's term in custody. He'd been brought to the court from a detention centre near the South Korean capital to argue for his release. Well, Jen Moon is a freelance journalist in Seoul, and she was there when all of this unfolded at 3 a.m. So, Jen, welcome to the programme. What exactly did you see?
James, it was shortly after 3 a.m. this Sunday morning, after the court's decision, when hundreds of pro-President Yoon Suk-yeol stormed, pro-President Yoon Suk-yeol protesters stormed the Seoul Western District Court. They were smashing windows, breaking down doors, blasting fire extinguishers. They swarmed inside, tore down computers and other furniture. Some are moving their way up to the court office, running up floor by floor, going by room to room, crashing a lot of furniture there. One man was seen with a metal pipe in his hand, yelling for the judge that had made the ruling, with her specific name being called out there. They were engaged in physical altercations with police officers just outside the court, and 86 were arrested, and they're likely to face legal consequences ranging from fines to time in jail.
And who were they? I mean, supporters of him, yes, but what, mostly young men?
Right. They were part of an estimated crowd of 44,000 supporters of Yoon who had gathered outside the court from Saturday night through Sunday morning, calling for the release of Yoon Suk-yeol. We're learning that many of the 86 arrested men are in their 20s and 30s. It's a demographic group that's been increasing in numbers at pro-Yoon protests recently.
And it's being given the parallels with the January the 6th riots in America. I mean, what is this, all of this saying about democracy in Korea?
It's at a real crossroads. This is an unprecedented scene here. Attacking a court was unprecedented in South Korea. Seeing such violence erupt in protests hasn't been seen in this country. We've only seen peaceful protests back in 2017 when then President Park Geun-hye was impeached. So this is something new, and it's something that we need to wait and see out.
And briefly, what's the latest? The detention for Yoon has been extended, and there's a separate impeachment case as well, isn't there, that's happening in the Constitutional Court?
Correct. So the Constitutional Court continues to deliberate whether to permanently remove him or not, a part of the December 14th decision by the National Assembly. He's been absent from the hearings, but despite that, it's been ongoing. And if the court rules against him, he'll formally lose presidency.
Jen, many thanks. The freelance journalist Jen Moon there bringing us up to date on all the latest from the South Korean capital, Seoul. You're listening to the BBC World Service. This is NewsHour, coming to you live from London with James Kamara-Sami. Let's return now to the truce in Gaza and the impact of it on the humanitarian suffering in that territory. In the last couple of hours, the United Nations has said the first aid trucks have arrived in Gaza since the ceasefire came into force at 11:15 local time. So will enough humanitarian aid now start to reach the people of Gaza who need it so much? Our chief international correspondent, Lise Doucette, has been speaking to the United Nations Senior Humanitarian and Reconstruction Coordinator for Gaza, Sigrid Kaag, who's in Jerusalem.
I think it's a very fluid and fragile situation. We also know that people have been more than desperate for so many months. Chaos has to be factored in, but we have tried with Qatar, with the US, with Egypt, and in very effective cooperation with the Israelis to try to find ways in which to channel that. There are agreements with the civilian police, so we are hopeful that the risk of chaos can be as mitigated as possible. But one should expect joy, despair, people out in the streets. It will not be easy, but we have prepared to the extent this is humanly possible.
As you know, we've heard time and again this word flow, that aid, hundreds of trucks will flow into Gaza, and they never did. The numbers, as you know, have been far, far short of what is needed. Are you convinced that the logistics are in place in terms of the UN being able to deliver the aid, the Israelis allowing, not holding them up by strenuous inspections? Are you sure that there will be the flow this time?
We've crossed the T's and dotted the I's in recent days. My colleagues' technical teams have been in Cairo precisely for that purpose, speaking with the Israelis, the Qataris, Egyptians, and the US. There's a fairly detailed agreement in place. We know that assistance will come from Israel, West Bank, the very effective Jordan route that has been working. Trucks are entering as we speak from Egypt via Kerem Abu Salem, Kerem Shalom, and aid will continue to flow from Ashdod. Am I sure with a certainty 100%? Things can happen, but these are the arrangements, and there are operational crisis cells and rooms in place to troubleshoot if and when something risks derailing. The flow is important, the continuity, and of course, ultimately, as we've often said, the distribution to people inside Gaza. Nothing matters if it doesn't reach people.
The UN Senior Humanitarian and Reconstruction Coordinator for Gaza, Sigrid Kaag, speaking to Lise Doucette. And Lise joins us now from the Saudi capital, Riyadh. Lise, let's turn to the regional aspect of this, as your presence in Saudi Arabia suggests. There is an important one. And you've been speaking to the Qataris, who, of course, played a crucial role in mediating the deal. How confident are they that it will stick?
Well, Jane, you heard just how cautious Sigrid Kaag is, talking about a fragile situation. You can sense in her words cautious hope, because something has to be done. And similarly, when speaking to the Qatari government spokesperson, Majid al-Ansari, he described it as the last hope for Gaza. He was very cognizant of the difficulties, the delay of these few hours this morning in the ceasefire start, because there was some technical problems. It seems also some angry accusations between Hamas and Israel as to who was to blame. That is going to mark every single step of this process. There's absolutely no trust. There are spoilers on both sides. But James, you know, the history of the Middle East is not just one of wars. It's also of peacemaking and deal breaking. This deal may be perhaps the most fragile of them all in decades. And so there is reason to be worried. But what is different about this deal is just how engaged the region is. Qatar and Egypt as the main mediators, the intermediary in these indirect talks between Israel and Hamas, along with the United States. Arab states in the region, both moderate states with very strong relations to the United States, they have been arguing from the beginning that they want to be part of a solution, which for them has to include a Palestinian state. And they will do everything possible to try to make this deal stick. There's a coordination office in Cairo. The Qataris and Egyptians will put resources on the ground. And of course, tomorrow, a new president will be sworn in the White House, who's already proven that he's ready to exert pressure to make sure these deals stick. But as always in peace, only the warring sides can make peace. And there's great doubt on the side, certainly on the side of the Israelis. They're not hiding it. They call it a temporary ceasefire. And Hamas, of course, has been significantly weakened in this war. They say what they want, an end to the war, but they may want a role in Gaza. And Israel says that's a red line.
Yes, and I'm just seeing that Donald Trump's envoy also saying Hamas will never govern Gaza. America has been very engaged. You talk about regional engagements. Obviously, America has been very engaged, the outgoing Biden administration. What are the expectations for the Trump administration, though, in terms of continued engagement? Clearly, it is taking a lot of credit for what's happened, but over the long term?
That's a really crucial question, Amy, because we've seen in President Trump's first term, certainly with the kind of showy summitry he had with the North Korean leader, diplomats said they'd never seen summits which were so ill-prepared. Nothing was prepared in advance, not even any briefing papers about what the outcome should be. And of course, the outcome was very disappointing. This time again, so you had Witkoff, who's the new envoy. He sat at the tables. It emerged that everywhere he sat, he said, right, Trump wants this done by the 20th. And President-elect Trump has boasted that there are his U.S. diplomats who know about the rivers and the wadis and the mountains, but they don't know how to make a deal. But making a deal in the Middle East is not a deal in a day, as President Trump sometimes talks about. You've got to sit there for days and days on end. The outgoing Middle East coordinator, Brett McGurk, spent months at a time in the region. And if the United States takes its eye off this ball, it could so easily unravel. If they're prepared to sit at the table to put pressure, not just on Hamas, but also on Prime Minister Netanyahu, as we've seen, there is a greater chance it may stick. But there are no guarantees.
No, none indeed. Lise, many thanks. Lise Doucette, our chief international correspondent there, joining us there from the Saudi capital, Riyadh. You're listening to the BBC World Service. This is NewsHour, coming to you live from London with James Kamara-Sami. We have been hearing throughout the programme about what the ceasefire might mean for the people of Gaza and the wider region. And we will, of course, continue to report on that. But for the next few hours, all eyes will be on the expected release of three Israeli women. They are not, of course, the first to have been released since the beginning of the war. Dr. Yael Moser Glassberg was part of a team of doctors who treated the women and children who were released by Hamas 50 days into the war towards the end of 2023. And she told me what they had been like when they arrived at her hospital.
We received kids with moms or kids on their own. Like, the teenagers were alone without parents. The kids were very quiet, very, very afraid. Pediatric patients, pediatric wards are very, you can hear cry, laugh, but there is voice. There is, like, you, it's loud. You can hear life within the ward. The ward with the returned hostages were very quiet, and it was weird for us on the first day. And then every time we got back kids, we got used to it already, that the first 24, 48 hours will be very, very quiet. And suddenly later on, they started to talk. They started to speak. They didn't whisper anymore, but they were whispering at the beginning because they were asked to whisper at captivity so nobody will hear them.
And their physical condition?
All of them returned with around 10 to 15% decrease of their body weight because of lack of food and starvation. All moms, all of them, without exception, all the mothers lost more percentage of their body weight than the kids because they gave up the food for their kids. Hygiene-wise, it was terrible. They came back infested with a lot of with lice, no shower, no hygiene for those 50 days. So the hygiene-wise was very bad. Infectious disease-wise, they had diarrhea and like vomiting and all kind of infectious diseases while in the Gaza Strip in captivity, as well as when they came back to us. As well as isolation of the stool culture with various kinds of infectious microbes that you don't see on a regular people who lives in a developed country. So they had this profile of microbiome.
Dr. Yael Moser Glassberg there. Well, three Israeli hostages set to be released today. We understand the process of transferring them to the Red Cross is underway. And we can speak live now to Dr. Osnat Levitzion Korach, who's General Director and CEO of Shamir Medical Center just outside Tel Aviv, where, Doctor, you're preparing to receive hostages who are going to be released as part of this deal. What can you tell us about the sort of preparations you have had to make?
Hi, everyone. Happy to be on this call. First of all, want to understand, we don't really know what to expect. These people who are, so today we're looking forward, all the nation here is very, very excited to the release of the first three women. after 471 days. What we know, so we don't know. What we do know is that there are two major things that we need to take care of. First of all, is the physical conditions that we know that from people who came back before that, starvation, lack of food, continuously of threats, no sun. If they're apparently they were under the tunnels, in the tunnels, no sun, torture, physical and sexual torture as well. So when we look at the physical injuries, there are some injuries that happened to them while they were kidnapped. But then, and that some of them were not properly, did not receive.
And sorry, just to cut in there, I think the two of the three who are coming out today, we understand had gunshot wounds in the abduction. So they have
What they say, yeah. So we don't know what the status of their injuries is now. But what we do know is we do know that after such a very prolonged malnutrition, we can expect muscle and tissue wasting, organ damage, weakened immune system with infectious diseases, neurological effects. So it's a really total body effect. The other thing is the mental condition. It's loneliness. Some were kept alone. PTSD, anxiety, depression. There was a lot of psychological terror on the hostages saying, you know, no one cares about you. They forgot all about you. You'll be here until you die. We're going to kill you, and so forth. The way we prepare ourselves, and that's actually the way all five hospitals that were designated to receive the hostages are preparing themselves. First of all, the main thing is to approach them very gently, to give them back their control over their lives, which is the main mantra, which means when the doctor approaches them is, can I examine you? Can we do this? We recommend this. So that's the mantra, that's the theme. The other thing regarding refeeding, one of the things that we're very afraid of is their refeeding syndrome. So there's a protocol of how to provide food very slowly, you know, very thoughtfully. And the other thing is how we approach them mentally. I mean, it's everyone's. It will be overwhelming for everyone. And the families, I'm sorry?
Yes, no, I was going to ask about the interest, the clear kind of public interest in them as well. Is it going to be difficult to shield them from the public?
We don't. Exactly. So that's one of our main goals, is to shield them from the public. Everyone wants to know, but it won't happen. The places are very much secure. No personal details will be released. It's theirs, and it will be kept under very secretive protocols. Sorry?
And for you, just briefly, before we reach the end of the program, I mean, for the doctors dealing with this, what are the challenges you face?
So, of course, we're also human beings that suffered since October 7th. We're all part of this terrible event. So we also will take care and will take care of the staff that will take care of the hostages that will return. But of course, we're not the issue now. The issue now is to give all the attention to our hostages that are finally coming home. And the thing is, we need to remember that it's just the beginning. We have 98 people still in hostages. Now it's 97 because they brought a body in a very complicated operation last night.
It's all complex. But look, thank you so much for sharing that with us. We really appreciate it. Dr. Osnat Levtsion Korach, General Director of Shamir Medical Center. And that brings us to an end of this edition of NewsHour. From me, James Kamara-Sami, and the rest of the team here in London, thanks very much.
There's a divide in American politics between those who think democracy is in peril and those who think it's already been subverted, hollowed out from the inside. As President Trump returns to the White House, we go through the looking glass into a world where nothing is as it seems. The Coming Storm from BBC Radio 4. Listen wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
Egal, ob Sie gerade erst beginnen oder Ihr Sicherheitsprogramm erweitern, herausragende Sicherheitspraktiken zu demonstrieren und Vertrauen aufzubauen, ist wichtiger denn je. Vanta automatisiert die Einhaltung von ISO 27001, SOC 2 und mehr, spart Ihnen Zeit und Geld und hilft Ihnen, das Vertrauen Ihrer Kunden zu stärken. Darüber hinaus können Sie Sicherheitsüberprüfungen vereinfachen, indem Sie Fragebögen automatisieren und die Sicherheit Ihrer IT-Infrastruktur mit einem kundenorientierten Trust Center demonstrieren. Über 9000 globale Unternehmen wie Atlassian, FloHealth und Koora nutzen Vanta bereits, um Risiken zu managen und Sicherheit in Echtzeit nachzuweisen. Erhalten Sie ein spezielles Angebot von $1000 Rabatt unter vanta.com/horen.
One and one is two. Of het nu gaat om wereldnieuws of een verhaal van om de hoek. Wat ons raakt, dat willen we delen. Daarom brengen we bij het AD verhalen die het delen waard zijn. Omdat ze raken, ontroeren of precies uitleggen hoe het zit. Samen delen we het AD. Lees het AD nu tijdelijk vanaf 1 euro per week. Stopt vanzelf. Ga naar ad.nl/kiosk.
Egal, ob Sie gerade erst beginnen oder Ihr Sicherheitsprogramm erweitern, herausragende Sicherheitspraktiken zu demonstrieren und Vertrauen aufzubauen, ist wichtiger denn je. Vanta automatisiert die Einhaltung von ISO 27001, SOC 2 und mehr, spart Ihnen Zeit und Geld und hilft Ihnen, das Vertrauen Ihrer Kunden zu stärken. Darüber hinaus können Sie Sicherheitsüberprüfungen vereinfachen, indem Sie Fragebögen automatisieren und die Sicherheit Ihrer IT-Infrastruktur mit einem kundenorientierten Trust Center demonstrieren. Über 9000 globale Unternehmen wie Atlassian, FloHealth und Koora nutzen Vanta bereits, um Risiken zu managen und Sicherheit in Echtzeit nachzuweisen. Erhalten Sie ein spezielles Angebot von $1000 Rabatt unter vanta.com/horen.
There's a divide in American politics between those who think democracy is in peril and those who think it's already been subverted, hollowed out from the inside. As President Trump returns to the White House, we go through the looking glass into a world where nothing is as it seems. The Coming Storm from BBC Radio 4. Listen wherever you get your BBC podcasts.